Welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Early this month, a firestorm erupted when Scholastic released the children's book called A Birthday Cake for George Washington by Raman Ganeshram and illustrated by Vanessa Brantley Newton. The School Library Journal called the book highly problematic, and Kirkus Reviews labeled it, quote, an incomplete, even dishonest treatment of slavery. But neither of these critical reviews generated a public response from Scholastic. So today we're talking about, quote unquote, political correctedness and giving children a rich and honest account of history that also appreciates how old they are and age appropriateness. Today, how do we provide kids with books that are, you know, give them the whole full story? And what does that mean? Today, we have a panel of guests. First with us from Berkeley is Jody Sokolauer. She's the managing editor of Rethinking Schools, a nonprofit publisher and advocacy organization dedicated to sustaining and strengthening public education through social justice teaching and education activism. Jody has taught middle school, high school, and adult learners in the Bay Area, including 6 years at Berkeley High. She is the co-editor of Rethinking Sexism, Gender, and Sexuality. So that is Jody Sokolauer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. Also with us is Jesse Hagopian. Jesse teaches history and is the Black Student Union advisor at Garfield High School in Seattle. He's editor and contributing author to More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing, and recipient of the 2013 Secondary School Teacher of the Year Award from the Academy of Education, Arts, and Sciences. Welcome, Jesse.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. And with us is Deborah Menkart. Deborah is co-director of the Zinn Education Project and executive director of Teaching for Change. She is going to be selecting with us the best multicultural books for children, the best social justice books for children. She'll be joining us a little bit later. And today we want to hear from you and your recommendations. What are some books that you would like to recommend that tell an honest story about some aspect of history in this country, whether it's race or gender, sexuality, anything in the political realm that is also appropriate for children? And that's a hard balance to strike, but we'd love to hear your recommendations at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Should we be having this conversation at all? Should children just be reading anything and everything? That's also an argument that's been raised. So we're taking your recommendations and your thoughts on this subject. Again, the number is 866-798-8255. You can also shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's read a little bit more about this story. So the controversy around the publication of this book, A Birthday Cake for George Washington, it got a lot of attention, especially on social media. We saw it everywhere, Facebook, Twitter. Some people say the book should not have been pulled off the shelves, and it should be up to the readers to evaluate the book. The National Coalition Against Censorship, the First Amendment Committee of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, all of them said, quote, while it's perfectly valid for critics to dispute a book's historical accuracy and literary merits, the appropriate response is not to withdraw the volume and deprive readers of a chance to evaluate the book on their own and the controversy for themselves. Deborah, let's start. Oh, Deborah is not with us yet. So let's talk to Jesse. Jesse, had you heard about this, and what was your initial reaction to the book first?
Absolutely. I heard about it and was part of the campaign to pressure Scholastic to actually withdraw this book, because I think it's absolutely outrageous.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes, I can. The book depicts smiling, happy slaves with their slave master, who happens to be the first president, George Washington. And it's a story that features Hercules, the chef, who is a black slave of the president's, happily making him a birthday cake, and with his daughter's arms around him, and the president, they're smiling all throughout the book, just couldn't be more pleased to help their master celebrate his birthday. And at one point in the book, they even refer to the president's wife, Mrs. Washington, as that great woman. And it's just an over-the-top, smiling, happy slave narrative that unfortunately has a really sordid past in our American history curriculum. In fact, for much of American history, that was the main narrative that mm-hmm. was taught to children in school, that slaves actually enjoyed slavery. And this feeds into that really racist narrative and stereotype. And it's so insidious to begin that with a children's book, to raise our children believing such a false narrative is truly damaging. And in fact, I liken it to what's happening with black neighborhoods and gentrification. You know, I wrote a piece for The Progressive called The Gentrification of Black History. Mm-hmm. And I think the same process is happening in Seattle and cities across the country, where formerly black neighborhoods are being erased, and the culture and the people are being pushed out and paved over, and there's nothing really left to mark the people that used to live there. And the same thing is being done in our history books. You know, the true history of the struggles against slavery mm-hmm. That African Americans engaged in is being written right out of the books.
So Scholastic, this is their announcement back in January. They said they're announcing that they're stopping the distribution of this book and will accept all returns. While we have great respect for the integrity and scholarship of the author, illustrator, and editor, we believe that without more historical background of the evils of slavery than this book for younger children can provide, the book may give a false impression of the reality of the lives of slaves and therefore should be withdrawn. But at the same time, on the other side, you have the National Coalition Against Censorship, the First Amendment Committee of the American Society of Journalists and Authors saying this should not happen and that people should be making up their own minds about that. What do you say about that?
Well, I would say that people did make up their own minds. And they flooded Scholastic with emails and signature gathering campaigns saying this whitewashing of history has to stop. And that, you know, they flooded the Amazon reviews with one-star reviews. So the people really spoke. And I think it's indicative of a time we're living in with the Black Lives Matter movement rising across the country. People are no longer willing to just sit back and watch them say the slaves enjoyed slavery. It's just far too much to take anymore.
And this isn't really the first time or the only book that's come under attack for whitewashing slavery. National Geographic, of all places, released a children's book in 2013 called Master George's People, George Washington, His Slaves, and His Revolutionary Transformation. Another one, A Fine Dessert, released last year. I don't know what it is about baking and desserts and sweets that has to do with this, was widely critiqued for its depiction of, quote, happy slaves. This is not new. What is going on?
That's right. It's not new. And it fits a larger pattern. I think that the way American history is depicted in children's books, in textbooks, in curriculum for schools really falls into two patterns. One is the canonization or iconification of a few black leaders, and then the other is complete erasure. So you can see, for instance, with Martin Luther King, you will get some discussion and treatment of Martin Luther King and celebration of him in mainstream corporate textbook publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they don't discuss any of his ideas pretty much after the I Have a Dream speech. They don't discuss how he evolved to see the Vietnam War as a true crime against humanity, right? They don't...
or workers' rights.
All the work he's done
for workers' rights and poverty.
That's exactly right. So they'll raise you to the status of an icon and really, you know, negate most of your thoughts, or they'll just completely erase the true history. And I think that that's been played out across the country in many different ways in our classrooms.
And I want to go to Jody Sokolauer. Jody, managing editor of Rethinking Schools, you've taught middle school, high school, and adult learners. If we can kind of remember back to your middle school days, what does a book like this do to a child? If, you know, what is the harm that you would see on the individual child absorbing a book like the one we're talking about?
Well, I think that for African American kids, the constant procession of how bad Black history is in the schools is really damaging to self-image. And it's not just that, I think it's the combination of underplaying the evils of slavery, minimizing resistance, and pulling all of the content out of resistance.
Mm.
So the kids end up, I mean, Jesse's more of an expert on this than I, so I will defer, but kids end up feeling like every time Black people are talked about, they're victims, which doesn't make you feel any stronger or have any more nuanced view than being portrayed as evil or something. It's really bad. And I know that a few years ago I was teaching U.S. history in 11th grade, and, you know, kids have every year, they have like one day on Martin Luther King and one day on Rosa Parks, which completely pulls Rosa Parks, who was a lifelong activist long before the Montgomery bus boycott and long afterwards. You know, she was not somebody who was tired and sat down on the bus because she was tired.
Mm-hmm.
She
But that's the narrative.
Right. She had a strategy. She was part of a movement. She was a leader, and she kept on being a leader. But that's all. Kids learn the same surfacey thing about Martin Luther King, as Jesse said, and also about Rosa Parks over and over and over again. So I had a class of 11th graders, and I said, kind of in passing, as part of an introduction, we're going to be looking at some of the differences between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and what was different in mm-hmm. how they viewed the problems in the United States and what their strategies were. And the kids were like totally upset. They were like, what do you mean there was no difference between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X?
They are one person.
They were one person. They wanted the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if the point of education is to raise a society that's capable of solving problems, the way that you're able to look at problems, analyze them, and solve them is by being able to understand history, you know, look at contradictions, understand that different people had different ways of looking at the world, and that how you see the world and how you define the problem and where you want to get to defines your strategy. That's what kids need to be pulling apart. And I wanted to mention one other thing that this kind of
sure.
goes back to what you were saying earlier about what's age appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with because I edit a magazine that's filled with articles by teachers about teaching. I often work with teachers on their articles. And I was working with a first grade teacher who she was telling me that she was reading a book to the kids about Martin Luther King, and she wanted to write about this lesson that she had done. And she skipped the page where he was assassinated because she thought that the kids weren't, it wasn't age appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And three of the kids in the class said, "Didn't they kill him? We need to talk about that."
Mm.
And
this is middle school?
No, this was in first grade.
Oh, first grade.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, kids are surrounded by a lot of stuff, and I certainly think that it's important for education to be age-appropriate, and mostly that means following, you know, listening to kids and following their lead. But kids know about a lot of stuff, and kids are wrestling with violence all the time in their lives and on TV, and they need support and help making sense out of it. They don't need it to be silenced.
That's a big part of this conversation as well. What is age appropriate might be, you know, it's relative, maybe from community to community, from home to home. You know, somebody's kids are watching the evening news. Somebody's kids have no idea what's going on. I'd love to, talk about who makes the decisions about what is age appropriate, what's not age appropriate. Is there some kind of a council? Is who makes these decisions? And we are also taking your calls if you have any questions about these age appropriateness of books, telling children about our history in a rich way, in an honest way, but also in an age-appropriate way, and what does that mean? And if you have any recommendations for us, that would be great. The number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, and let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Any book that claims that African American slaves were happy and only happy is objectionable, obviously. And a viable society requires that most of its population identify positively with its history, or at least identify with its potential future. And any society that doesn't pay attention to that is going to fall into sectarianism. And I just think that's an important point. And we talk about the whole truth, and I don't think anyone author is ever going to get at the whole truth. And we also have to realize that we're a community, a society, going forward. We have to do a much better job of indicating agency amongst people that are formerly oppressed. And we also have to do it, you know, within the context of we're a society, and we need people to identify with our society, be willing to sacrifice for that society. And that's just the point I wanted to make.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the call, Cynthia. Let's go to Jesse Hagopian. Do you want to comment on that we should be focusing on a brighter picture so we'll have a brighter future?
Absolutely. One of the things I do in my classroom before we ever start studying history is we ask three questions. Who am I? What is history? And what does history have to do with me? And in the course of answering those questions, we look at a lot of different historians and how they've answered those questions, and the kids wrestle with those ideas and try to figure out, do they agree with those historians? Do they disagree with those historians? How do they define history and how it impacts their own lives? And one of the essays we read is by a man named James Lowen, who wrote a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Mm.
And he has a thesis that people love studying history, but they hate studying it in school. So people will spend millions of dollars a year to investigate history, whether it's flying to D.C. to go to the Smithsonian, or it's going to see movies like the Titanic that was the highest grossing film when it came out, or spending their money on historical fiction that are often topping the bestseller list. But then when you go into a classroom, kids are asleep drooling on the desk, right, through history class.
Yeah.
And he says, so what's gone wrong? Why do people love the stories of our past so much, but then in school they won't pay attention. And he has a couple of theses on that. And one of the main culprits is the blind patriotism that our textbooks are designed to instill, so that the kids already know what the answer is going to be before they open the book.
Can you give me an example of that? What does that mean?
Absolutely. So the thesis that James Loewen puts forward is you can look at the cover of a textbook to begin with. Often the chemistry textbook will just be called Principles of Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But a U.S. history textbook will be called The Rise of the Great Nation, with, you know, the flag and the eagle. And so it's not about a critical investigation or a scientific investigation of the topic. It's about convincing you that America got it right over and over and over again. And if you already know the answer to the question, then it makes studying the topic very dull, and most of the controversy is withdrawn. And I think that we do our kids a great disservice when we try to make history all about supporting the current society that we have and not about a critical investigation. One, it's just boring and unexciting.
And that's been proven.
Right. And two, it's actually what James Loewen says. It's lies my teacher told me.
Lies my teacher
I think
told
we
me. We can find that online, right?
Anymore. That's right.
Okay. Lies my teacher told me. We are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. We have an email from Richard who has a question. He asks, how do we evaluate a book, and what criteria are employed to make a determination that a given book is appropriate at a particular age for a particular child? Is it just an arbitrary opinion by one adult? Jody, can you talk to that? Who makes these decisions?
Well, I think it varies from state to state, but essentially I think big business makes the decisions. Big business.
Mm.
Because, you know, there are just a few different companies, Pearson, Houghton Mifflin, you know, who produce almost all of the history textbooks.
Right.
And one of the things that's really interesting, if you look at history textbooks, even ones that have a claim to diversity or to multiculturalism, is that 90% or 95% of the content is about white men rulers.
Mm.
And then the way that you'll see diversity or lip service to multiculturalism is like there'll be a picture of a woman every three chapters with a cut line. Or there'll be a little a pull-out box that has something about Benjamin Banneker, you know, that so that it's just, it's kind of tacked on later rather than being central.
After somebody says something.
Right. So here's an example. It's like if you look at the founding documents of the United States, so most mainstream textbooks talk about the Constitutional Convention and you know, the whole discussion about the democracy and the republic and the conflict.
So, Jody, I am going to have to cut you off just for a little while. We will come back to this.
Okay.
We do need to take a break.
Go for it.
This is your call. I'm Hannah Baba. We are still taking your calls and emails, so keep them coming. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Tell us if you're a first-time caller. We always like hearing from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half an hour here on KALW, it's Reveal from the Center for Independent Reporting. Time right now is 7:31.
Welcome back to Your Call. I'm Hannah Baba, and it is 10:31. You're listening to Your Call, and we are talking today about books, children's books. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting our show. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll talk to financial journalist Paul Mason about his new book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. Is neoliberal capitalism in crisis? Will information technology fundamentally transform our economy? The guest host will be Matt Martin, so that is tomorrow. And today we want to hear from you, how do we teach history to our children? We've been talking about storybooks that have been pulled for portraying slaves as being happy in books, a recent pull by Scholastic, and that this is not a new thing. We're talking to Jody Sokolauer, managing editor of Rethinking Schools. She's taught middle school, high school, adult learners in the San Francisco area. She's co-editor of Rethinking Sexism, Gender, and Sexuality. And we've been talking with Jesse Hagopian, who teaches history and is the Black Student Union advisor at Garfield High School in Seattle, editor and contributing author to More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing, and he won Secondary School Teacher of the Year from the Academy of Education, Arts, and Sciences. And joining us now is Deborah Menkart. Deborah is co-director of the Zinn Education Project and the executive director of Teaching for Change, a nonprofit that selects the best multicultural and social justice books for children and educators. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
It's a pleasure to join you and also Jody and Jesse. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
And we are still taking your calls and recommendations for books, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Deborah, we were talking about textbooks and who writes them, who really determines what is age appropriate for children. And so if you can get in on that conversation and let us know about these textbooks, who gets to decide what goes in a history book, for example?
Well, certainly not the children that are subjected to reading them and carrying them around. They're back-breaking weight.
Jody was saying it's business. It's big business.
Yes. And really, with the Zinn Education Project that I co-direct with Bill Bigelow from Rethinking Schools, we would argue that really the focus should be for teachers, for students, is teaching and learning outside the textbook, because to give, no matter how good a textbook, even if they were fabulous, it gives the impression that all of U.S. history could be reduced to one text, which would be just about impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than arguing over the quality of one textbook, we provide resources, lessons, many of the lessons that, in fact, Jesse Hagopian has both used and developed, that are lessons that allow students to step into history, to read various sources, books, primary documents, to engage themselves, film clips, so that they're not really dependent on any one textbook.
And the hope is that that is what they will take away rather than what's in the textbook.
That's correct, because even oftentimes because the project is named the Zinn Education Project, we get people saying, well, if schools would be better off if they just mandated that everybody read Howard Zinn's People's History. And while we love Howard Zinn's People's History, substituting one text for another is really not the solution. We want students to recognize the fact that you need to look at multiple sources, and that it's not just about what you read, but also the critical thinking and arguments and discussions that you engage in, the people you talk with. It's not just about reading any one text.
And I also wanted to note some textbooks that, you know, how textbooks have been dealing with Native Americans as well. Across all states, 87% of references to Natives portray them prior to 1900 with no clear vision of what happened after that.
Right.
In half of the states, no individual Natives or specific tribes are named. 62 Native nations only are named in standards. Most are mentioned by only one state, One Nation, the Iroquois, is mentioned in 6 states. Nebraska textbooks portray natives as lazy, drunk, or criminal. Washington is the only state to use the word genocide in relation to natives. And that word is used in the standards for 5th grade U.S. history. So, Deborah, what else is being done to counter these false or incomplete narratives?
Right. In fact, that study was released, and when it was discussed at the National Council for Social Studies, and there's an organization that we encourage everybody to follow called American Indians and Children's Literature that really tries to expose that bias, also the bias in what's available in children's books, because this really starts while we're talking about textbooks, which are often we're thinking upper elementary, middle, or high school. This starts in early childhood, and so there is a campaign that we just launched last week with many of the people, the same groups and people who were involved in the campaign to recall the birthday cake for George Washington that I think you talked about that a little bit earlier in the show, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so the group of the groups and the individuals that worked on that campaign, particularly the Ferguson Response Network, American Indians and Children's Literature, and a number of children's librarians, early childhood educators, felt that it's not enough to get Scholastic to recall a bad book, but we also need to focus on getting them to offer a better selection. And we thought strategically it's good to focus on one publisher, and once we're successful there, we'll move on to the next. But Scholastic really permeates, particularly elementary schools, with the book fairs and the catalogs that go to children's homes. And so we're inviting children and teachers and parents to write letters to Scholastic about what they see and don't see in the catalog. Right. And we've already got letters from teachers and schools that say 100% of my students are Navajo, and there are not, you know, it's not like we're just finding a couple of books. There are no books that, that represent them that they can see themselves in or their peers in other schools and communities could see
them.
That's
incredible. We are taking your calls, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. We do have some folks on the line. Let us go to Sarah in Berkeley. Welcome to your call. Sarah? Hi, Sarah. Okay, let's go to Jesse in Pacifica. Welcome to your call.
Hi, I just, speaking to the point she made earlier, it's the information age, and shouldn't we be pointing kids, you know, teaching them the skills to find the information that's relevant to them and focusing on that rather than giving them the information?
Thanks for the call. Jody, what do you think? Are schools encouraging kids to go online and look for stuff on themselves, on their own?
Well,
Jody?
It's not just going online. It's like what your goal is and how you're approaching it, and particularly around critical thinking. And the example I was going to give, that I started to give before about the Constitutional Convention, it's actually like we have an article at Rethinking Schools that's also at ZIP that's about, like, if you're looking at the Constitutional Convention, you want to ask kids, okay, who was there, who wasn't there? You know, so women weren't there, indentured servants weren't there, Africans weren't there, Native Americans weren't there. What would they have wanted? And then you can have a broader discussion about, like, well, what were really the weaknesses and strengths? And that's something that carries, I think that's what Deborah's getting at, about how do you set up class discussions that are broader so that kids can see themselves in the history, they can imagine themselves in the history, and they're looking critically at what's in the book and what's not in the book. And then they're in a position to go look for other sources that and look at them critically also.
All right, we have some recommendations coming in as well. Let's go to Lotus in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi. We found a book, a children's book, about building the transcontinental railroad.
I'm sorry, can you say that again, Lotus? Your line was a bit...
There is a book.
Thank you.
Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad, entitled To the Golden Mountain.
To the Golden Mountain.
it's a series, Great Journeys, by Lila Pearl, who's done a whole series of children's history books, L-I-L-A-P-E-R-L, and 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad will be coming up in 2019, from 1869, and the Chinese also get short shrift, because there's also almost nothing, or it is labor story. So there's also a history museum for the Irish Railroad.
Okay, American Lotus, Railroad. I'm sorry, your line is difficult, but I think we got the gist of it. Got some good recommendations there. And we will be putting these up on yourcallradio.org. Denny from Richmond couldn't stay on the line, but he wants to recommend A is for Activists. I want to read that one. Let's go to Jane in Sonoma County. Welcome. Hi, Jane. You're on your call. Are you there? Okay. So, I wanted to ask Jess, in this recent piece, you mentioned that the Bill of Rights Institute offers pretty much whitewashed classroom lesson plans for teachers across the country, the Bill of Rights Institute, and that it is funded by the infamous Koch brothers. And so it cherry picks events to hammer home a mostly libertarian message about the sacredness of private property. And, for example, also quiet cover for Trayvon Martin's killer, George Zimmerman. Tell us more about how much influence do these outside groups really have in what kids are taught in our classrooms? This was very interesting to read.
Yeah, it was a shocking expose that I read from Bill Bigelow, one of the editors at Rethinking Schools, about the Bill of Rights Institute and the funding they get from the right-wing billionaires, the Koch brothers. And it really is disturbing to see the way that these people can manipulate the curriculum. I got an email just a couple days ago that was sent to every teacher across Seattle from the Bill of Rights Institute at our school email addresses.
What did it say?
And it was encouraging us to use their curriculum to teach various aspects of American history, which of course do what we've been talking about for this entire show, downplaying the agency and power and struggle of African Americans, specifically in this one lesson, teaching with current events around the Trayvon Martin case. I found particularly objectionable that has a discussion of the stand your ground laws without discussing the events and the way that Zimmerman attacked Trayvon Martin. But I think this problem goes far beyond just the Bill of Rights Institute. I think we're seeing an full-on frontal assault of all kinds of ethnic studies programs around the country. I mean, most notably in Arizona in 2012, they banned the Mexican-American Studies program. This
right.
program was having the best outcomes for the Latino students there, highest graduation rates, best even test scores. That, you know, we don't believe in judging kids by test scores in the social justice education community, but most of the corporate education reformers do. And here was a program that was raising the test scores, and yet they shut it down because it actually engaged in a critical discussion about American history.
Even here in San Francisco, San Francisco State was the first university to start ethnic studies. It was where it was born, and now students are protesting the possible elimination of that of their classes. So this is happening even here.
Yep. That's exactly right. And, you know, in Colorado, they moved to get rid of discussions of social unrest and civil disobedience in their AP history curriculum, and it took, you know, thousands of students walking out of class and showing people what civil disobedience looks like to have that restored to the curriculum. So the good news is, while there is a full-on assault of any kind of empowering curriculum for students of color. At the same time, with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, people are reviving the lessons of, for instance, how Black Studies was won originally at San Francisco State University through mass sit-ins from the Black Student Union there.
Mm.
And across the country, similar rallies and protests and sit-ins won us the right to learn about our own cultures, and we're going to have to revive those lessons if we're going to save those programs and be able to allow kids to understand their own history and culture.
We are still taking your calls at 866-798-TALK. If you have any recommendations for us for children's books, or if your textbook is magically wonderful and thorough, we'd like to hear from you. 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Deborah Minkart, since Zinn Education Project selects multicultural and social justice books for children and educators, why don't you shoot some at us? Well, why don't you give us some? What are some of the books that are on your list?
Oh, yeah, there's some wonderful books. Well, you know, we actually worked on looking at a list of titles after the controversy over and the successful recall, protest and recall of the book about, Hercules, who was enslaved at Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. We looked at books we would recommend, say, on teaching about slavery. And there's one about Love 12 Miles Long, about Frederick Douglass's mother who walked 12 miles to visit him. There's Tea Cakes for Tosh, about a grandmother who makes tea cakes for her grandson. And it's a lovely intergenerational book where the grandmother has made these tea cakes for her grandson, and now he's learning the recipe because she's getting older and there might be a time when she doesn't remember it. And embedded in the story is also her just sort of discussion with him a little bit about the tradition of when those tea cakes were made, and people who were enslaved were able to put one in their pocket and save it for their child at a moment when they could share that with them quietly. And so I think there's books that look at ways of introducing the history of enslavement to children at different ages and in ways that are developmentally appropriate and also include not just the enslavement but also stories of resistance. And then more for middle school on that same theme, there's a book about the pearl. Let me just get people who were enslaved in Washington, D.C., organized an escape on a ship called the Pearl, and one of the people who had been enslaved at the White House helped to organize that escape. Oftentimes people don't, when children are learning about the history of D.C. and the White House, they don't think about people being enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of our questions. We ask people often to think of how many presidents owned and sold people, and
And that kind of shakes the narrative of that patriotic aspect that Jesse Hagopian was talking about earlier, the founding fathers. This is our country. This is how it was built. And, really holding the founding fathers and the presidents in really, really high regard. And that somehow talking about slavery and their slaves that they owned might tarnish that?
Right, yeah. And actually Hillary Clinton was quoted yesterday, I think it was in South Carolina, saying our country was built by people who had each other's backs. who understand that at our best we all rise together. Well, it's more like built on people's backs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that this, the central role of people who were enslaved to this country's history, and not just the South, that's the other narrative, is that it's often seen as just a problem of the South. There's the bad South and the good North, and that's both when we talk about slavery and when we talk about the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's often our challenge when we're looking for children's books, is not just finding good books, but finding books that help complete that narrative. So if we're looking for books about the Civil Rights Movement, then we want stories that also talk about certainly books that challenge many of those myths, books that talk about the role of ordinary people, that talk about women, that talk about the fact that the movement started before 54 and kept on going after 65. But then stories that are set in the North, which are still hard to find. There's whole areas where they're just a absolute scarcity of books. You know, we have the large, and the media, large, you know, reports on large numbers of children coming across the border from Central America, and yet finding children's books with Central American characters or authors is very difficult. Finding books about featuring contemporary stories about Africa, African countries mm-hmm. that name the country and that are not, you know, books about wild animals or, you know, people on a safari is very, very difficult.
Right. That is Deborah Mankart, co-director of the Zin Education Project. They select multicultural books, social justice books for children and educators. Also with us is Jesse Hagopian, teaches history at the Black Student Union, and is the Black Student Union advisor, Garfield High School in Seattle, and Jody Sokolauer is managing editor of Rethinking Schools. We're still taking your calls at 866-798-8255. What about the home? I have a 12-year-old. I have a 9-year-old. Issues of race and gender and religion as well, Islamophobia that is high these days. These issues, they hear about all of this. They see the worry in our faces. They hear the adult conversations. And then they go to school and you just hope that there is a teacher that will be able to have these conversations and continue them and move them forward. If that's not happening, what, as a teacher, what is my role as a parent? What is the ideal parent to you, Jody, since you've taught middle school, high school? What should I be doing at home?
Well, you know, I have a friend who called me just last week, and he was appalled at what was happening in his son's second grade classroom that I think the teacher was talking about Martin Luther King Day and said something about lighter people and darker people. Mm. And he said, help. And so I actually gave him a stack of Rethinking Schools books to take back there. And, you know, that the Rethinking Schools, what we do is it's a magazine that comes out 4 times a year, and it's almost all articles written by teachers about how to bring social justice issues into the curriculum, exactly what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. you know, and how do you start with kids' lives and how do you bring in real issues and teach kids the skills they need, but in the context of critical thinking and using history and all subjects in school as, you know, mirrors and windows. And we have a whole series of books. We have one on rethinking elementary education. We have one on globalization. We have one on the environment. We have this one you mentioned before that we just put out about sexism, gender, and sexuality. And they're all, there's one about the border. And they're all about how to grapple with these things at in age-appropriate ways, in ways that will really engage kids. So I think it's a great resource to share with parents, and for parents to share it with their teachers, and you know, and ask what's happening at your school around professional development. You know, like what kind of discussions are teachers having with each other about appropriate ways to talk about slavery?
Because to be honest, teachers are overworked. They're tired. For a teacher to actually go beyond the curriculum that is in front of her, in front of him, to kind of take this on as a passion project, you know, the likelihood of that is less and less in this time.
Well, it's very hard with all the pressure around testing and everything else, but
right.
It's the core of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say one other thing, too, is like if you're trying to figure out what to do as a parent, go to the library and ask the children's librarian. Children's librarians are amazing resources.
Remember the library?
And
yes,
that's what they do all the time, is look for wonderful books. And
yes,
they're always really excited to have somebody ask them.
Right. Okay. Let's go. I think we only have a couple of minutes left. So, Jesse Hagopian, what should a parent do that that could help in this regard?
Well, I completely agree with what Jody outlined there in terms of using the resources we have from children's librarians, and using the resources at Teaching for Change and at Rethinking Schools. There's some great places to go to. But I think there's something else that was mentioned in terms of the way that high-stakes testing is driving teachers to teach to the test. It's narrowing the curriculum and making it harder for educators to engage in this kind of social justice, critical thinking pedagogy.
And says social studies is not even focused on, because they need to focus on the math and the reading and the writing.
That's exactly
at
right.
All.
And so I think the parent movement to opt out of the test is a really important component to building a better education for their children.
Okay, thank you. That's Jesse Hagopian. Earlier we heard from Deborah Menkhart. With us also was Jody Sokolauer. Thank you all so much for this very interesting conversation. We'll put links up at yourcallradio.org. And we still want to hear from you, so keep those emails coming at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and thank you for listening. On the next Your Call, we'll talk to financial journalist Paul Mason about his new book, Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. Is neoliberal capitalism in crisis? Will information technology fundamentally transform our economy? Can we make a future of less work and shared wealth? On all counts, Mason says yes. Hear why and join the conversation on the next Your Call with guest host Matt Martin and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.